This is the Ingles Information Aisle with Leah McGrath, helping you eat healthy, feel great, and understand your nutrition. Now, here's your host, Ingles dietitian Leah McGrath.
Good morning and welcome to the Ingles Information Aisle. This is Leah McGrath, your Ingles dietitian. Thank you for joining us on this Saturday morning. You know, I always try and emphasize with our Ingles customers how important it is to get information from science-based resources and to make sure that the information you're reading about online is coming from reputable sources. That's so important. There's so much misinformation out there in the world of food and nutrition these days that it can get really confusing for our customers. So I thought it'd be important for us to talk to an organization that really tries to stick with the science on a lot of issues and has been working for the past 40 years to try and keep consumers informed about a variety of different issues. So joining me by phone is Greg Jaffe, and he's with the Center for Science and the Public Interest. Hi, Greg. How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm great. So let's let everybody know a little bit about who you are, first of all, and maybe we'll start out. What is the Center for Science and the Public Interest?
So the Center for Science and the Public Interest is a consumer advocacy and education organization. We have sort of two missions, which is to conduct innovative research and advocacy programs in health and nutrition, and then also to provide consumers with current useful information about their health and well-being. We've been around. We actually had our 45th anniversary just a couple of months ago.
I'm sorry. I thought even older. Okay, that's great. 45 years. Okay. And how did CSPI get started? Like, what was the genesis of CSPI?
So CSPI was started by our current president, but was one of three scientists who founded CSPI way back when they really wanted to bring science into the advocacy arena on behalf of consumers. So they started Center for Science and Public Interest, and over the years we've focused primarily on health and nutrition, and we try to help people eat healthy, and we also try to advocate on behalf of consumers. Primarily domestically, but sometimes internationally, to ensure that the government is doing its job and also that industry is doing its job. So we're a watchdog of both the government and a watchdog of industry to make sure that consumers are getting accurate information, that they understand the science and the relationship between their health and their diet and nutrition.
And a lot of people, you know, I've been aware of CSPI for a long time. I don't even know if you realize this, that I was a dietitian in the Army, and I did my internship at Walter Reed. And one of the things that they recommended at that time, when I went to University of Maryland, was to get a subscription to the Nutrition Action newsletter. That was actually recommended to us. I don't know if it was in my undergraduate or if that was recommended during my internship. But I remember, and that was 20 years ago, that was a big deal. I mean, and I remember that being one of the publications I looked at. Can you talk a little bit about what the Nutrition Action newsletter is?
Sure. So we have a Nutrition Action. We call it a health letter. It comes out 10 times a year. And it really is an attempt to help consumers out there eat healthy and to understand the relationship between the food they eat and their diet and their health. So the newsletter will have articles about, you know, different hot topics in the food and nutrition area. One month we might have an article about diabetes and how what you can do to prevent diabetes from occurring or how you can eat when you have diabetes. We might have articles about the different kinds of oils that are out there, partially saturated, monosaturated, and so forth, and telling people which oils they should use for which kinds of foods that they might be cooking. We also have we attempt to, you know, look at the science, if there's science about particular diets that are out there, or about, you know, specific vitamins, for example, what's the benefit of those from your health and so forth. We would try to summarize those scientific journal articles that are out there. We have a chef on staff, so we have recipes on how to eat healthy. recipes that you can do. And we also rank products. So in different months, you might see us ranking all different kinds of breads out there, which are the healthy breads, which have less salt in them, for example, which are the better ice creams to eat if you're going to eat an ice cream, and so forth. So there's a lot of useful information out there on how to actually, you know, eat healthy. We have approximately 650,000 subscribers in the U.S. for that newsletter. And so that is the primary funder of the CF Center for Science Public Interest. People pay $10 or $20 a year to subscribe to the newsletter. So we ask those people also to make individual donations, and some of those people make $10 donations and some of them make $5,000 donations. And so that's where we've got our primary funding for CSBI. We do take some private foundation grants, which make up about 5% of our operating and revenue in a given year. But Nutrition Action Health Letter accepts no advertising, and CSPI actually accepts no corporate funds at all or any government grants. So we really do pride ourselves of sort of being independent of any conflict of interest. We want to be a watchdog of the industry, and if the industry has a good product out there, then we're going to support it. But if industry has a bad product out there, we're going to try to get it off the market or make people aware of how many calories it has or whatever the concern is. Similarly, we're going to watch the government to make sure they are doing things in the best interest of the consumer.
So I want to make sure people know how to find you all. You have a website, and that really can take people to a lot of locations. That's cspinet.org. And as Greg's been telling us, you can sign up for the Nutrition Action Health Letter right through that main website, cspinet.org. And you can also find Center for Science and the Public Interest on Facebook, on Twitter, and on Pinterest as well. Not Instagram yet, Greg?
No. So in terms of the website, you are correct. You can sign up for the newsletter, and you can sign up to get it a hard copy mailed to you 10 times a year, or you can get an electronic version sent to you. So we are in the electronic age. You can get it either way. And as I said, it's a very useful thing for people who want to eat healthy. We are on Twitter, at CSPI. Instagram, we're at CSPI _nutritionaction.
Okay, so there's a couple.
And we are on Facebook and Pinterest.
Great, okay.
So we are there. And you also, when you're there, we do have an action alert part of our CSPI net.org site, and you can if you want to be on our mailing list for when we do action alerts, when we're trying to do policy initiatives to try to get Congress to do something or the agency to do something, you can sign up and get those alerts at the same time.
Okay, stay tuned to the Ingalls Information Hour. We're talking with Greg Jaffe of Center for Science and the Public Interest. Welcome back to the Ingalls Information Aisle. This is Leah McGrath, your Ingalls dietitian. I'm speaking with Greg Jaffe of the Center for Science and the Public Interest. You can find them online as cspinet.org. And Greg has been telling us a little bit about the history, the 45-year history of CSPI and their mission, basically, to keep consumers informed and be a watchdog agency in a lot of issues of health and food and nutrition, and how you can actually get the Nutrition Action Health Letter, and that comes out, Greg, you were saying 10 times a year?
Yes, that's correct.
So what are some of the big initiatives that you would say that CSBI has been involved with over the past 45 years that people might really associate CSPI with this particular initiative?
Okay. Well, I haven't been there for all 45 years, so I can't speak all
okay.
the way back. But I would say that, you know, I can give a couple examples of some initiatives that we've worked on that I think are been really important to consumers. One was trans fat. So back in the early to mid-1990s, we looked at the scientific data and found out that we felt that trans fat, which is partially hydrogenated oils, were not healthy for you. And so we filed a petition with FDA at that time to get them to label, to have trans fat labeled separately on those nutrition facts labels that everybody looks at on their supermarket packages. And it's been, we've been working on this campaign now for 20 years, and the first thing we did was FDA did, about 10 or 12 years later, did grant that petition and required labeling of it. And then many, we've worked with, worked and pushed industry so that they would eliminate as much trans fat as they could from the different foods that they were producing. And now we've asked FDA to actually revoke the generally recognized as safe status of trans fat. Hopefully in the near future, there will be very few foods out there that have any trans fat in them. And so that's a long-term battle that we've been doing because the evidence supported it. We were one of the first to come out. Now I think there are many different scientific organizations, the American Medical Association, many different people, nutritionists and others, who agree that trans fat is something that doesn't need to be in our food supply and is not good for our health. So that would be one example. We've done a lot on school foods and marketing to kids, trying to get soda out of schools, especially grammar schools, trying to make sure that there isn't an undue influence of marketing to children on television and so forth. And we've, again, done a combination of pushing the government to act as well as being a watchdog of industry and pushing the industry to reduce, to change their ways. We've done a lot on sodium, to reduce sodium in our food supply, and that's been a long-term thing and will continue to be a long-term trend. And one of the things people may know us about also is we've done a lot on misleading label claims. So we work really hard to make sure that consumers are getting accurate information and aren't misled by products that are out there. And I can give you two recent examples. If anybody goes to the supermarket, say, you might see there's a new variety of Cheerios out there called Cheerios Protein.
Oh, right.
And the agency and Cheerios came out with that a little while ago and claiming, because one of the fads these days is more protein.
Sure.
And so they came out and said that their Cheerios had more protein, and therefore you should purchase this variety instead. The reality was that it did not have very much more protein, less than 25% more protein, if I remember my numbers correctly. At the same time, however, the Cheerios protein contained 17 times as much sugar as the original Cheerios, and they didn't mention that to consumers. So in reality, where you were not only getting not a lot of additional protein, but you were in fact getting a huge amount more of sugar that went unnoticed,
and
in obviously all their advertising. So we've sued them to force them to change the label on that.
Greg, one of the things I saw as a dietitian is that, you know, and I don't know if this came out right away with those cereal boxes, but in very little, very, very tiny writing beneath that, they would say something about most of this additional protein is coming from milk. You know, they would say, you know, it would say something like 11 grams of protein, and very, very small letters, it would say, if milk is added or something like that. So in reality, the amount, like you're saying, the amount of additional protein was very small, and most of that was only if you were adding milk. And it would have to have been cow's milk, because most of your plant-based milks don't have that amount of protein. So it was very misleading.
Right. So that just gives you one example. And other examples are Panera Bread, I think, you know, earlier that last year agreed to remove dyes, additives from foods. And while that was good that they removed some dyes that are actually harmful, they reduced dozens of different chemical-sounding ingredients. And some of those were actually perfectly innocuous, such
right.
as calcium propionate or sodium lactate. And so, you know, part of this was good science, but part of this was just advertising or marketing. And so we do try to make those distinctions for consumers. And what Panera was hiding, of course, was that, you know, one of their paninis has 1,000 calories and a day's worth of sodium. So,
yeah.
You know, the reality is that, you know, you have to be careful about the healthfulness of those foods, not whether or not they have a little bit of a chemical substance associated with them.
Well, you know, I don't know how you feel about this, but, you know, as a dietitian for a supermarket, I get a lot of consumers that they've been, their level of fear about food has been ratcheted up by a lot of fear mongers in social media, who tell them things like, don't eat anything with ingredients you can't pronounce. Don't eat anything with more than 4 ingredients. Don't eat anything that sounds like a chemical. And, you know, sometimes those chemical sounding things may be beneficial vitamins and minerals. So it's a very tricky time right now.
So I think two messages I would tell consumers, and they relate in part to the project that I work on, the biotechnology project with genetically engineered foods, and that is one, everything in moderation. So,
right.
You know, out there, the issue is should always be when you're looking at your food and your total diet. It's doing things in moderation. You don't need to go to those extremes to eat healthy. And the second one related to my biotech project is that you really have to look at things on a case-by-case basis. And that's an example with the chemical substances that are in foods. Also, some of them may be very harmless and some may be problematic, and you can't generalize. And similarly, with genetically engineered foods out there, I think there's a lot of misinformation that consumers are concerned about these things, but you have to look at it case by case. You can't sort of generalize, and I think that's what both the proponents of genetic engineering and the opponents of genetic engineering tend to do in the debate that's out there in the public.
Sure. We're going to be talking more with Greg about his part in the Center for Science and the Public Interest, which has to do with the biotechnology project. As we return to the Ingalls Information Hour, make sure you go to find Center for Science and the Public Interest online at cspinet.org. And you can find out more information about their Nutrition Action Health Letter and some of the initiatives they work on with food safety and nutrition. Stay tuned to the Ingalls Information Hour. Welcome back to the Ingalls Information Hour. This is Leah McGrath, your Ingalls dietitian. I've been talking with Greg Jaffe of the Center for Science and the Public Interest. And you can find CSPI on the internet at cspinet.org. And they're also on Twitter, Facebook, all the other forms of and platforms of social media. And Greg, what is your precise role? Like what's your project area with CSPI?
So I run the biotechnology project, and the biotechnology project really revolves around the issues, the scientific issues, and the regulatory issues around genetically engineered foods. So crops that have been engineered with an introduced gene that has some specific trait that might be beneficial to farmers or the environment or consumers, and how those crops get into our food supply, trying to ensure both that the regulatory system is making sure that those are safe to eat and safe for the environment, and also making sure that there's proper management of those, any potential risks by industry or farmers who are using those crops.
And how long has CSPI had this sort of project going on?
So I've been at CSPI for 15 years, and when I was hired, that was when the project was beginning. And so genetic engineer, consumers have been eating ingredients that came from genetic engineered crops for more than 15 years now. Because they were actually, some of them, these crops were grown even before the CSPI began the biotechnology project.
And what's your background that made you the person who kind of got in charge of all this?
So I have an undergraduate degree in biology and government, and I actually wrote my college thesis on this issue of recombinant DNA, genetic engineering, and how it could be regulated. So I've been following this issue on and off for more than 30 years of my career. And I'm a lawyer, and I worked at the government for a number of years, not on this issue, but on just getting polluters to clean up.
So, oh, okay.
But it was my background where I've been following this issue that got me involved.
So what do you think, do you find that people are surprised that CSPI, first of all, let's say, what is CSPI's position on biotechnology and genetically engineered crops? Can you summarize that in a few sentences?
Sure. So our view is that, you can't generalize about this technology. You need to look at it on a case-by-case basis. And we want to ensure that it's both has proper oversight. But we have looked at the genetic engineered crops that are currently grown in the United States, and I can tell you what those are in a second. And we've looked at the scientific data and all the data that's out there related to those. And I think it is our conclusion, as well as I think an international consensus out there, that foods made from those genetically engineered crops are safe to eat. So any foods or ingredients that come from those particular crops are safe to eat. I can't talk about future crops because I don't know what those will be. This is not an ultra-hazardous technology, and so I would expect many of those new crops, and maybe even most of them, to be safe, but one needs to look at them on a case-by-case basis. And so that's sort of our view about these things. We do think there are some benefits to the environment for farmers and to farmers who are growing these. Farmers get some benefits, the environment gets some benefits. Not a lot of benefits yet to consumers, but those will probably come in the future. But you do have to properly manage this technology like other agricultural technologies to make sure that it's used in a manner that will allow it to flourish and not be wasted away.
And I want to make sure, I don't want to run out of time, certainly, but before we do, I want to make sure we mention that if you go to cspinet.org and look for the biotechnology project, they have a very nice section there on frequently asked questions. So if you do have questions about genetic engineering, there's a lot of your potential questions that'll be answered right there. So we have about how many more minutes? About 4 more minutes. So, Greg, you know, there's so much going on right now with the whole question of the labeling of genetically engineered ingredients and products. And do you have some thoughts on what's happening right now?
Well, I guess what I'd like to tell consumers is, you know, and again, I said you need to look at these on a case-by-case basis, but you also, the devil is in the details. And so we can't begin to talk about labeling unless we know how these engineered crops enter our food supply. And you can't really do that until you understand how we genetically engineer a crop. So when scientists genetically engineer a crop, what they do is take a corn plant that has thousands of genes in it, and they introduce one new gene, and that gene might come from another organism, and it has a specific trait. It might be a trait that helps that crop, for example, deal with drought, so it will still grow in drought conditions. So they introduce that one new gene, and that gene usually produces a protein. And we eat lots of proteins in our diet, and we eat lots of genes in our diet, lots of DNA. Now, how does that corn end up in our food supply? It primarily ends up as highly processed ingredients because the vast majority of the corn that we grow in the United States is field corn, and that goes to either animal feed or ethanol, or it gets into our food supply in things like high fructose corn syrup or corn oil or corn starch. There's very small amounts of the corn in the United States that we grow that's sweet corn, what you and I would look at and eat. So when we make many of those highly processed ingredients, we eliminate both all of the DNA, both the native DNA of the corn plant, plus the little bit of DNA we added with that new gene, and we also eliminate all of the protein. So oil, for example, has no DNA or protein in it. So if you have a jar of corn oil that's made from genetically engineered corn next to a jar of corn oil made from non-genetically engineered corn, they're biologically and chemically identical. There is no way to tell the difference because any of the quote-unquote genetic engineering has been eliminated in making the oil. And so you need to think about all of these things when you come to labeling. Would it be misleading to label one of those as genetically engineered corn oil and one as not when there actually aren't a biological or chemical difference?
Mm-hmm.
And so the crops that are out there that are genetically engineered are corn, primarily corn, soybeans, sugar beets, cotton, canola, alfalfa, papaya, squash, and I may be missing one in there. And the way most of those enter our food supply is through these highly processed ingredients. So, I mean, if you're eating papayas from Hawaii, you're probably eating genetically engineered papayas, and there is some squash and sweet corn out there. But the vast majority of genetically engineered foods that we eat are really ingredients within a processed food. And so I want to make that clear to everybody. So then you can think about whether to label or not. Part of it is not just about a right to know, but there are also issues of how do you do that in a scientific way that's actually accurate to the consumer and neutral and not misleading.
Yeah, this is there's so much misunderstanding about this whole issue. And, I feel like we have such a long way to go to try and help consumers understand. I want to make sure we again mention to folks that there are some really great resources on CSPI's website, cspinet.org, including their frequently asked questions in their section on the biotechnology report. Greg, we certainly greatly appreciate you taking the time to talk to us about CSPI and the mission of CSPI, and look forward to hearing more about this issue from you all. Thanks.
Well, thank you very much.